As the icon of the North, the polar bear has captured the attention of people around the world. But the polar bear faces an uncertain future. Last fall, the U.S. Geological Survey released a series of reports showing that if current trends continue, changes in sea ice will result in the loss of about two-thirds of the world's polar bear population by the year 2050. For a species whose life cycle depends entirely on ice, the accelerating loss of sea ice means less time to hunt and eat, leading to declines in body condition, reproduction, and ultimately, survival. Drawing from recent research, the World Wildlife Fund appeals for donations to defend the world's 25,000 polar bears against global warming. Are polar bears really endangered or threatened? And what part does politics play in their survival? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Now that the polar bear has been listed as threatened, does the federal government acknowledge that global warming is a real phenomenon? Is the Arctic sea ice continuing to disappear because of human activity, or is it a natural state of flux? In the 40 years that polar bear hunting has been banned, how has the animal's population fared? And how do variables such as El Niño and shifts in the jet stream affect predictions of its future? Our guest for this conversation is Eric DeWeaver, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Services, Center for Climatic Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
And welcome to University of the Year.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me to your show.
Well, let's start by talking about that recent decision on May 15th that made the polar bear into a protected species after such a long debate. Can you start by talking about what was decided, how, and what significance it has?
Well, the ruling that came on May 15th said that the polar bear is now going to be protected as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. And this comes as a culmination of a very long period of deliberation on this question. I think the most important aspect of the decision is that it acknowledges that climate change is indeed happening. It's happening very rapidly in the Arctic. And the consequence of the loss of sea ice in the Arctic is going to be very dire for polar bears. I think this is an important step forward in the sense that the government has acknowledged the existence of climate change. They may prefer not to use the words global warming to refer to it, but nonetheless, just looking through the final ruling for the listing decision, it's very clear that the scientists were listened to on this issue and that the decision was informed by best available science and accepts the idea that climate change is happening very rapidly in the Arctic and it's going to have bad consequences.
Can we make a distinction between those two phrases, climate change and global warming? Does climate change imply just more extremes as opposed to a steady warming globally?
Well, I think the term climate change was originally sort of coined and used by people who were reluctant to use the term global warming and who were also reluctant to kind of accept the idea that global warming is caused by carbon dioxide emissions and ultimately it's caused by human activity. However, more recently, the term climate change has been embraced by scientists working in the field because it has this other significance of saying that when you think about global warming, you tend to think about thermometers and you tend to think about just this one aspect of the temperature going up. However, lots of things change in the climate system because of carbon dioxide emissions. I think the most interesting scientifically, if you read the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is changes in the hydrological cycle. There's a northward shift of jets and storm tracks, which happens very consistently in climate model simulations of global warming. So it's an interesting term because it's had this evolution from, in some sense, a term of denial to a term of art to describe sort of the complexity of climate change that's going to happen.
Just about, I guess it was 3 days later in the New York Times on May 18th, an editorial was published entitled "Not Much Help for the Polar Bear," insisting that even though this ruling came through, it really might not have that much effect on the polar bears.
That's right. That's right. I think this is the primary criticism of the listing decision that's come out, although it has also been criticized by conservative groups who, you know, do not accept the idea that the science is telling us that the world is warming. What the decision says and what I sort of endorse in the decision is it says that climate change is a problem, climate change is happening, and best available science tells us that climate change is happening because of human activity. However, the actual amount of protection that's going to be afforded to polar bears as a result of this decision is very limited. The decision essentially says that because global warming is a diffuse menace to polar bears, the Endangered Species Act therefore does not have the power to do anything about it. There's a little bit of history to that. It's not an arbitrary sort of thing to say. I think even sort of hypothetical Department of Interior run by Al Gore or someone like that wanted to use the Endangered Species Act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, there would be court challenges to that for sure. There's a substantial amount of kind of precedent and legal decision that's already been undergone in the Endangered Species Act. And one of the questions that always comes up is, how can I say that, you know, how can I as the Department of Interior say that you can't perform such and such an activity because of its bad consequences for a species? So we know, for instance, that you can't take pot shots at the spotted owl, you know, and you can't take a chainsaw and cut down the tree with the spotted owl nest in it. But it gets a little bit more ambiguous if you say, I want to build a real estate development next to spotted owl habitat. And someone will say, well, you know, there could be a cat that sort of lives in one of the apartments and the cat could be a menace to the bird. Or if you say, I want to graze cattle in a particular region and that region looks like it would be good habitat for a particular species of bird that's in trouble. And what the courts have said is that for you to act on the Endangered Species Act and prohibit an activity, you have to establish a fairly direct causal link between the particular activity in question and harm to an individual of the species in question. So I think what the courts are going to be looking at is this question of, if I emit some carbon dioxide through an activity of my own, and it's not very much, then does that really constitute harm in a way that can be causally demonstrated? It wouldn't be something that's decided on an individual level. They're not going to regulate my own personal activity or yours. What they would do is they would regulate through a Section 7 consultation in the biological opinion the, say, leasing of an oil field. And then the question becomes, do you have to consider as you lease that oil field as part of the National Petroleum Reserve the consequences of extracting that oil out of the ground, refining it, and then burning it, and then producing carbon dioxide, which contributes to climate change, which contributes to sea ice decline, which harms polar bears?
It's almost as if you could say, well, if this contributes to sea ice decline, it probably contributes to various other problems around the world. If you have a factory that's in Alaska or Washington State or someplace, it sounds as if you could get, what would you call it, economic paralysis on the basis of saying, well, you contribute in a small way to this problem.
Well, I think this is an issue not just with the Endangered Species Act, but it's an issue in all attempts to assign responsibility to greenhouse gas emissions. The argument that the Environmental Protection Agency used in the court decision, in the court case, which was, I think, Massachusetts versus the Environmental Protection Agency, the state of Massachusetts and other states that joined the suit claimed that the EPA has to regulate carbon dioxide emissions because it's now been discovered that the EPA, that carbon dioxide is a pollutant and therefore it comes under the jurisdiction of the EPA. The EPA argued that, no, this is not a pollutant in the standard sense of the word, you know, that was kind of used when the Environmental Protection Act was actually written, and so therefore they're not obligated to do anything about it. So, I mean, I think the problem with global warming, what makes it sort of unique, I guess, is just the fact that it is global. It's global both in the sources of the greenhouse gases that are causing it, and it's very global in the sense that almost any activity that you can imagine, human, animal, or otherwise, is impacted by it. And because a lot of these impacts are bad impacts, it becomes very difficult to say who's responsible for this, under what heading does it fall. The Supreme Court in that decision made a very interesting argument, which is that, well, if you are responsible for any of the things that global warming impacts, then you can't pass the buck and the ball is in your court. I don't know that they would necessarily make that same decision in the case of the Endangered Species Act. It has a lot to do with how these acts are written. But when you think about what should we do about global warming? I don't think anybody really thinks that the Endangered Species Act is the ideal way to regulate the U.S. economy or the world economy. It tends to be more of a last resort kind of thing. It seems to me that the primary way that you would like to do it is through an act, through something like the Climate Security Act, which has been proposed by, I believe it's Warner and Lieberman, but I'd have to check the names, a federal act that either imposes a cap and trade system to curtail emissions of carbon dioxide or just imposes a tax on carbon emission. That kind of mechanism regulates the economy in a way that's sort of appropriate because it's on an economic sort of economy-wide scale.
Would this tax on emission then somehow be applied to the right place?
One would hope. But these are all sort of issues that have to get worked out sort of by legislatures. I don't really know what's in these acts. As you can see, I don't quite even know who the sponsors of them are. We probably should point out, though, that it's my understanding at this point that the three main presidential candidates have all signed off on one form or another, not signed off but endorsed at least one form or another of cap-and-trade system.
I realize that using endangered species acts is not the way to, you know, like you said, to legislate this. But on the other hand, it gets attention, including with the polar bear. Why the polar bear as opposed to penguins, as opposed to seals? In other words, is it considered a sort of canary? Why the polar bear in particular?
Well, I think it's probably a little too glib to say that the polar bear is being used as an excuse to regulate carbon dioxide. And I think some of the rhetoric that I've heard in recent days about the new polar bear threatened status is sort of to that effect that, oh, these greenies, they're just trying to control the economy. It's very fair to say that this is an important species and this is a species that's going away. And if you look at any of the impacts of climate change and global warming, they all come down to a particular individual or a particular species or a particular, you know, group of individuals, the Dutch with their low-lying areas, the Bangladeshis, people living in coastal areas like New Orleans. You know, you could argue that any one of these groups of people or species or individuals is somehow a special interest. And you could also perhaps argue that protecting a single species doesn't really rise to the level where you'd want to regulate the world economy on the basis of that species. But if you want to think of the polar bear as a poster child, I think the first thing to think about is the polar bear as a representative of the Arctic ecosystem. Because clearly if the sea ice goes away, it's not just the polar bears that are affected. It's also the seals that use the ice in many of the same ways that the polar bear does. It's also birds in the Arctic. It's also the entire food chain that gets affected by the presence or absence of sea ice. You know, there's a saying that I think comes from sort of the dark times of the Soviet Union that if a person dies, it's a tragedy.
Stalin said
right,
that.
That's right. Stalin said that. If a person dies, it's a tragedy. But if a million people die, it's a statistic. And I think this is an important point to make when you're thinking about the impact of global warming on ecosystems. One of the unfortunate results that kind of is discussed in the IPCC reports, it's also something that researchers here work on, people like Jack Williams in the Geography Department and John Kutzbach at the Center for Climatic Research, is this question of, you know, how many overall species are going to become extinct because of climate change? And the answer to that question is rather grim. It's something like 30% of species living today are expected to become extinct over the course of this century because of global warming.
Wow.
This is a little bit like Stalin's statistic. And so if you want to say that the polar bear is somehow the poster child for all of those species, certainly it's easier for us as human beings to think about and grapple with the problems and the issues that face a single charismatic, powerful, also furry, cute, and sort of, you know, lovely
visible,
polar bear.
Yeah.
Than it is to think about 30% of all species. I think that is fair. One of the problems with 30% of all species is that some of those species may not have even been discovered yet. Some of those species could be nematodes that live in the soil, and as I walk over them, I wouldn't even be aware of their existence. So bringing the issue to the attention of the public through a polar bear and through, you know, thinking about how the polar bear is going to go away potentially because of greenhouse emissions, I think that is fair.
Well, there's also a very limited number of polar bears. I mean, if it's a nematode, who knows how many, but we're talking tens of thousands of polar bears, which is a pretty small population, isn't it, for a species?
I don't really know the answer to that. You have to consider that it's not a particularly lush environment that they live in. The statistic that I've heard is that a polar bear requires about 43 seals per year to maintain body weight. It's a predator that has essentially one dominant prey species. It lives in a, you know, in a not very lush environment. I don't know if you would expect to see dramatically more than tens of thousands of polar bears in the world.
Well, I know that we're going to be getting into greater detail about these models of climate change that you've been working with in considerable detail. But before we go there, what do you say to the person who says, well, okay, 30% of species might die off, but they do that periodically anyway. We have these die-offs. What's to distinguish that kind of natural flux from what some people are calling a crisis here?
Here I would have to suggest that perhaps on a later show you could bring in an evolutionary biologist who could really address the question of what accounts for species die-offs. My very limited understanding of that is that the big die-offs that you see in the geological record are the result of things like asteroid collisions with the Earth, the Deccan Traps event, in which a very large part of, I guess, the surface of some part of the Indian subcontinent erupted in a giant volcano and sort of spewed out stuff. If you want to argue that global warming and the catastrophe that it brings to species rises to the level of an asteroid impact, I would think that's motivation enough for most people to consider some sort of mitigation strategy.
And can you also talk about the difference between calling something an endangered versus a threatened species?
Yes, this is an important distinction, and it's probably one that many people aren't that aware of, at least I wasn't, that for a species to be considered in danger, it has to be in danger of extinction as we speak. The threatened designation says that a species is in danger of becoming endangered within the foreseeable future. In danger of becoming endangered within the foreseeable future.
And is that what the polar bear was pronounced then?
Yes. So the polar bear is considered a threatened species now. The important distinction is that the threatened designation talks specifically about a foreseeable future. So in particular, it doesn't mean that the polar bear is about to go extinct tomorrow. And the important point here, I think, in terms of the deliberations that went into this decision and the science that went into it, is there's a lot of debate or discussion that you'll see in the media about, you know, are polar bear populations in decline? And the truth is that, first of all, it's very difficult to show population decline on a really population and range-wide status. It's not like the U.S. Census where we can just take census takers, you know, and have them go and knock on the doors of the polar bear dens and ask how many people are living them.
Have you had this year?
That's not how it works. I mean, it's a white critter on a white background in an inaccessible environment, and you know, you don't have an easy time figuring out the actual population-wide status. It's thought that out of something like 19 subpopulations of polar bears, maybe five are stable, five are in decline. I think there's one that's increasing, and the rest we don't know. There's a lot of bears living in Siberia that we really don't have the way of counting. In terms of which bear populations can you really exactly say that there's been a decline, I think there's really only one, and it's a bear population that's in Hudson Bay, and it's quite accessible for two reasons. One, Hudson Bay isn't in the Arctic. At least this is the western side of Hudson Bay, so it's accessible. The other reason is that it's a part of the polar bear range where polar bears spend a lot of time off the ice because the ice goes away in certain parts of the year.
Yeah, so why would that one be endangered? That's what I wondered when I read about that.
Well, that's an interesting point, but I guess all I want to say right now is that it makes sense that that's the first bear population where you can really say with absolute certainty that there's been a decline, because that's the one where there's a long-term record that you can look at, and that's the one where you can really go and count them easily. In the South Beaufort Sea, which is another place where polar bears have been studied intensively, we have every reason to believe that the population is declining. There's a very nice capture-release study done over the years 2001 to 2005, I think, where you know, you would capture the bears, collar them, release them, capture them the next year. And so for that sort of subpopulation of bears that was examined, the outcome was rather grim. In years where there were more than 125 ice-free days in a year, there were substantial declines in that subpopulation, or in the study population, I should say. But then you have to scale that up to the total population. You could never study the whole population and capture and release based
on what you see.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
We're going to talk about models for extrapolating global warming when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappan Brothers.
Found a team of archaeologists digging through your car's back seat?
Donate it now to this station through Car Talk's vehicle donation program.
Call 1-866-789-8627 or go to WPR.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Eric DeWeaver. He's a professor with the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison, and we're talking about polar bears most conspicuously, but we'll find out soon that these models of climate change that he's been working on really have ramifications all over the place, right up to our very backyards. So how did this whole work on these climate models come about?
Well, I guess perhaps the first starting point for thinking about climate models is really to look at the observations. I don't think that people would give much credibility to climate model projections if it wasn't for the fact that there's an uncanny sort of resemblance between some of the things going on in the world and some of the things that come out of climate models. In terms of recognition of what's been going on in the world, I think there you really have to start with the most recent IPCC report. I think that really was a landmark and a milestone in terms of bringing recognition of the problem both to the public and to the scientific community to some extent.
And can you give us the words behind that acronym again?
So IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's actually a panel of governments rather than a panel of individuals.
And were they the ones that got the Nobel Prize then?
They were indeed the ones that got the Nobel Prize. That's exactly right. And what the Nobel Prize is really being given for there, I think, is really a colossal effort. If you give the Nobel Prize to the IPCC in recognition of the IPCC report, it's not just giving them a prize for the most recent report. It's giving them a prize for in recognition of a process that began in the late 1980s. We're at the fourth IPCC report, and I think the most, you know, it's almost an inside joke. I think the most important aspect of the report is the single sentence in the executive summary of it, which says something to the effect that the warming of the climate system is unequivocal. And if you read through the IPCC reports, there's a lexicon of expressions of uncertainty in it. Things are considered likely. Things are considered very likely if there's more than a 90% chance that they're true. And so when they say unequivocal, you have to sort of read that in the background of all the other possible gradations of certainty that they could have used there.
Sounds like 100% to me.
It means 100%. The other thing, and the reason why I say it's an inside joke, and I learned this from Phil Jones, who's one of the IPCC authors when he visited here from the University of East Anglia. The inside joke is that when they made their first IPCC report, which I think was the late 80s or possibly early 90s, the terminology that they used at that point is that the warming of the climate system is not unequivocal. And so the word unequivocal is actually the closing of a parenthesis that was opened in the late 1980s. And if you look through the previous reports, you can see this progression of stronger and stronger terminology being applied to global warming. One of the most famous sort of steps along the way, when Ben Santer, I think, wrote some part of the executive summary, he said, "The balance of evidence suggests a human influence on climate," something very close to that anyway. And at the time, that was considered a conservative statement by some, but the press really got a hold of that, and they sort of trumpeted that, you know, we're going down this road, you know, we're getting toward, we're moving in the direction of saying that this is something people are responsible for. So that unequivocal statement, you know, it's really the end of a long process, and the Nobel Prize, I think, is rightly given in recognition of the process.
Is that the same as saying there is global warming and people are causing it?
Well, there's two separate statements, and I think I am sort of conflating them a little bit. The one statement is that the warming of the global climate system is unequivocal. The second statement is that it is very likely that most of the warming of the last 50 years is due to human activity. Words close to that. And so when they say very likely, they're saying that there's a 90% or greater chance that the warming that's happened, you know, in the latter half of the 20th century is caused by human activity.
And that human activity primarily carbon dioxide emissions?
It's carbon dioxide emissions. There is also an agricultural component of it, methane emission from agriculture. There are other sources. When you make cement, I think it releases carbon. I believe it's carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So it's also methane emitted from landfills. I mean, these are important considerations because if you drain the water out of landfills, you can reduce the methane emissions. That's a lot easier than retooling the economy to run on windmills or something like
yes.
that. So, you know, we really do need to consider the sort of totality of sources of these emissions. But the other thing I was going to say is that when you think of global warming, of course, you immediately think of thermometers. And one of the nice things about the IPCC report is that it went so far beyond thermometers. You know, when you look at a problem in, say, you know, nuclear physics where perhaps there either is or isn't a particular subatomic particle or something like that, there may be one experiment that you do. You build the world's largest collider and you sort of bombard this specific thing with that specific thing and there's a decisive experiment, or the Michelson-Morley experiment on the speed of light. In the climate system, you very rarely find such decisive experiments. And so what you fall back on is looking at large numbers of different indicators. And what's nice about the IPCC report is how thoroughly they've done that. We look at surface thermometers on land. They tell us a story. We look at passive microwave satellite records of sea surface temperature. They tell the same story. The land is warming. The ocean surface is warming. We look at temperature records from balloon launches because you know that you get your weather forecasting information from balloon launches. They tell a consistent story. And you look at the surface. You look in the subsurface ocean. You look in the sort of in the atmosphere. And where you look, you find this consistent story of rising temperatures.
And they're saying that this is not part of, say, a cycle of of ice ages.
I mean, I think first we ask the simplest question is it happening? And we ask it not only with thermometers, but we ask it with, you know, are glaciers receding? Well, they are. Is sea ice receding? Actually, it is. What about number of days of snow cover in the northern hemisphere? Number of days of snow cover shrinking in most places. The snow line is moving further north. John Magnuson from the Limnology Department here does such nice sort of examinations of how much lake ice is there at what times of the year and how does that compare with earlier records. So even before you ask the question of why, just getting the story straight and being able to say that this is happening unequivocally is such a colossal effort by so many people over so much time. You know, you often see the climate skeptic sort of view in the press somewhere that, well, there is such and such a person, you know, this astrophysicist from Harvard or somebody else who says this. And that's often given sort of almost equal weight to the IPCC document.
Right.
And if it were just a document by a single person, that would be fair. But I think it's important to consider the effort that went into these things.
And what does it say about acceleration, speed of warming compared
well,
to
if you look at
experience?
The trends, and there is actually a nice figure on this in part of the IPCC report. If you look at the trends that are happening recently, they're faster than the trends that have happened earlier. But this does then lead into the other question that you asked about, you know, is this part of a natural cycle? And I think this is quite an important problem, you know, especially important problem when you consider the Arctic. Now, over the course of the 20th century, there's a period of increase in temperature in the early 20th century. Then there's sort of a leveling off or a bit of a decline, and then there's a rise again. And understanding that leveling off, rising again, understanding that, I think, has been an important component of the IPCC research. One of the things that came out of it is that you could sort of capture this temperature behavior if you force climate models with a combination of natural forcing and anthropogenic forcing, where natural forcing would include solar variability, where anthropogenic forcing would include not only warming because of increases in carbon dioxide, but also cooling because in addition to emitting carbon dioxide, people emit a lot of aerosol, and that can reflect light back into space. It causes a haze. And depending on where you are in your aerosol emissions, if you're in a dirty period of your economy where, you know, you haven't passed the Clean Air Act and you're sort of not scrubbing the emissions.
Like, say, you're in China.
That's right. Then you can get fluctuations. On top of that, you have to consider that there is a natural component. One of the things that people like to talk about is heat transport in the Atlantic Ocean. If you regulate the heat transport in the Atlantic Ocean, you can have some impact on global temperatures. And so there are a couple of issues there. One is sorting out how much is anthropogenic, how much are people doing. And the other is that even in the case where global warming is proceeding and you're seeing things like sea ice decline in the Arctic, you still will always see some combination of natural variability and anthropogenic forcing. Right. So it's really not fair to say that, oh, you know, we had a cold winter last year and therefore we don't have to worry about global warming anymore.
There you go.
You'll see always a superposition of what nature does and what people do.
And how do you go about establishing a sort of real firm cause and effect between global emissions, sort of human-caused pollution and the global warming? Because let's say you establish that there's global warming. You can also show that we're emitting more. How do you pull the two together in an absolutely unequivocal way?
Well, I mean, first of all, the unequivocal terminology was actually only used to say that the climate system is warming. You know, how do you want to be sort of very likely? How do you want to be 90% sure that people are doing it? And the most direct way to do that is to simply look at what climate models tell us. It's not the only way you can look at paleoclimate. There are other things that you can do. But I think if you look at the IPCC report and the way they present the evidence, the most compelling part of that is that if you take a climate model and force it with the natural forcings and take away the anthropogenic contribution, the increase in greenhouse gases, then you do not get the warming that we've experienced. So, I mean, this is sort of perhaps a lead-in to talking about climate models. One of the things that, you know, I think we should take pride in as you know, University of Wisconsin people, as Badgers, is that, believe it or not, the very first climate model experiment was done by Chamberlain. Chamberlain, another man named Tyndall, another man named Arrhenius at the end of the 1800s. These folks were interested in the question of what causes the Earth to have the climate that it does, and also what causes ice ages. That was a big issue at the time. And so they started to think about carbon dioxide, and they started to think about the idea of selective absorption and emission of radiation, the kind of sort of modern way that we think about what keeps the Earth warm in the first place. And they made these sort of little paper and pencil calculations. Well, if you have an atmosphere which has this much sort of carbon dioxide in it, then how would you calculate the temperature of the planet? And this is an exercise that's actually sometimes given to undergraduate students in classes in the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Department because it's not particularly hard to do. What I want to point out about this exercise is that immediately when they did that, they started thinking, we emit a lot of carbon dioxide. People could actually change the amount of it. And then they did sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations as to how much climate change would you expect on a global mean basis with no computer, with no fancy stuff. The answer that comes out of that calculation is more or less in the middle of the pack in terms of what you find from modern climate models. And it's important just because it emphasizes this concept of a hierarchy of models. People will often say, oh, climate models are so complicated. There are so many things that are in there. It's just a Rube Goldberg contraption. How could you possibly trust what comes out of it? And there's a couple of ways to address that question. One is that there is a hierarchy of models. You can get similar results at lesser degrees of complexity in your models. Another way to address the question, this is what the IPCC really focused on, is let's run a bunch of climate models. Let's get 24 climate models. I mean, that's more or less the number of climate modeling centers there are in the world. And let's look at the model output from these modeling centers and see whether it agrees. See if the results that you get are consistent. Are there any that cool? You know, are there any that do the opposite of what you would expect? And the answer that comes out of that exercise, I guess there's two sort of notable factors in it. One is that, you know, you get these ranges of estimates of how much climate will warm that are pretty consistent, you know, even going back sort of to the prehistory of the subject. And the other is that you always get spread. Right. No two climate models are alike, and no two climate models will give you the same answer in terms of what you would expect in terms of how much sea ice is going to be lost, how rapidly in the Arctic, or how much is the global mean temperature going to warm because of carbon dioxide. So when I came into this process, I was commissioned to actually write a report for the USGS. And we can talk about a little bit more later on about the USGS and the nice work that they did. But the idea of the report was that policymakers wanted someone to explain to them, please, why climate models disagree. You know, and from my point of view, I mean, I almost kind of laughed when I was asked to do that because as a scientist, you wonder, why would they agree?
Yeah,
you know,
yes,
isn't
exactly.
It amazing that they unusual. Only spread as much as they do?
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, these are the kinds of, you know, cognitive disconnects that you expect, and it's sort of a fun area to work in. And so I set about writing this document and really try to talk intelligently about the different kinds of things that go on in climate models that would cause them to disagree, what the sources of uncertainty were. And I'm actually kind of pleased with this aspect of the final ruling decision that came out about the polar bears, that, you know, to the extent that they cited and quoted the thing that I wrote, they pretty much got it right. You know, they really, you know, they looked at the climate model output and they saw that it was uncertain, and they read an explanation of why it ought to be uncertain, and they essentially said, we accept that this information is uncertain, and we acknowledge that even though it's uncertain, it's still useful guidance. Now, in terms of what the uncertainties are in climate models, one of the, I guess, misconceptions that comes up a lot about climate models, and at, you know, sometime in the future this may change, but at the moment, climate models are not initialized. And what I mean by that, and where I see a misconception in this, is that you can't take a climate model and tell it, okay, you know, today there's this much sea ice in the Arctic, so let's march forward in time in the simulation and see what happens to that sea ice.
Why can't you do that?
And that's the question people ask. It's a fair question. Why can't I just take the sea ice that I know to exist from microwave observations from satellites or whatever, stick it in the climate model and see what happens to it? And the answer is that it's a delicate climate system. And if you put sea ice on the Arctic and it's not sort of compatible with the ocean temperatures of the Arctic, it's not compatible with the ocean heat transport in that model, it's not compatible with sort of how that model does its thing internally, then either the model will take that sea ice and it'll just, you know, double it, or it'll take that sea ice and just melt it all away and it'll be gone tomorrow. So the point is that what is a climate model? A climate model is it's a code. It's usually a Fortran code. It runs on a very large computer. And it takes as input sunlight. So given the sunlight, and then, of course, given the composition of the atmosphere, given all the things that we know about the physics of the climate system, it makes its own climate. So you give it a certain amount of energy, it takes that energy and it disperses the energy between the atmosphere, the ocean, sea ice, some on land, perhaps in lakes if it's a high-resolution model, and then it starts to radiate that energy back into space through infrared emissions. And at some point in the simulation, a stable climate develops. And when I say stable, I mean that, you know, on average, on a year-by-year basis, it receives the same amount of sunlight. Right. Of energy from sunlight as it radiates back into space. And that's the starting point for this experiment, which we call a global warming simulation. The starting point for the experiment is that the model has developed its own internally consistent stable climate, and then you change. Then you add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Or if you're a paleoclimate person, maybe you turn down the sunlight and see what happens and see if there's an ice age. Things that you can do logically and reasonably. But the consequence of that is if you do something to the model that simply initializes it to say, give it today's weather and climate, the reaction of that model is that now you've taken it out of its natural state and you've given it a state which in that model is not balanced. Because the climate that the model develops internally is not going to be exactly the same as the climate that's observed. It'll be close. It'll have the recognizable features. It'll have sea ice in the Arctic. It'll have an Azores high in the Atlantic. It'll have the Pacific high in the Pacific. It'll have a rain band near the equator. It'll have a storm track that sort of, you know, rains a lot in the Seattle area. It'll have very much of what you would recognize. It'll even have weather. The time step in a climate model, this is something that always surprises people. The time step in a climate model that marches forward in time is about 20 minutes. It's the same time step, more or less, that you find in a weather forecasting model. There are reasons for that, which you probably shouldn't delve into. They have to do with how information moves around in the atmosphere, the speed of atmospheric wave propagation, things like that. But as a consequence of that, it is a very total system.
What do you mean, though, by it moves ahead 20 minutes?
Well, in a computer code, and this is sort of an aspect of climate modeling we could talk about, how do I represent the laws of physics which govern the climate system? And of course, you know, the laws of physics are happening on a sort of molecule by molecule, yes, or atom by atom basis in the real world. We don't want to do that. So instead what we do is we make a grid. We make a computational grid which has a grid spacing, which is always more than whatever you want it to be. Let's say 100 kilometers on a side for a high resolution model. And then within each grid box, we have sort of mean variables, the temperature, the moisture of the atmosphere, the wind speed, things like that. And then using the laws of physics, we advance these variables in time. And what I'm saying is that between sort of steps, between snapshots of what the atmosphere is doing, there's a 20-minute interval. And it's an important consideration because it's not very long.
Yeah, that sounds pretty detailed.
In a lot of these climate simulations, you want to go out 1,000 years to see if the climate stabilizes. You want to do things like that.
1,000 years of 20-minute intervals.
That's right. It is computationally intensive, absolutely. it doesn't have to be. I mean, people have come up with stripped-down versions of this that run on your sort of laptop. The EdGCM is one, the Educational Climate Model. Very fun tool for education and teaching purposes.
We're going to go from simulated models to real politicians and what happens when climate experts have to deal with presidents and interior secretaries when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Wisconsin Public Radio's audience services is staffed by knowledgeable and friendly people who are ready to help you with your programming questions. They welcome your call at 1-800-747-7444.
Never before has a thriving species been listed under the Endangered Species Act, nor should it be. That's the remark of Reed Hopper of the Pacific Legal Foundation, a property rights group based in Sacramento, that is saying that they plan to sue the Interior Department over the recent decision on May 15th to list the polar bear as a threatened species. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Eric DeWeaver, and we're talking about polar bears and global warming. We've been talking about climate models that can sort of predict trends and where we're heading. Then we've got this polar bear, the largest carnivore on Earth. What is the link between the models that you've been working on and then the whole controversy over the polar bears?
Well, I guess my sort of take on the quote that you just read is that some of the early publicity that came out about the decision was to the effect that, oh, you know, the Center for Biological Diversity is going to sue because the secretary is not doing anything to help the polar bear and so on and so forth. From the secretary's perspective, he's expecting to be sued from both sides. He's expected to be sued for not doing enough, and he's also expecting to be sued for doing too much and going much further than I think Reed Hopper ever wanted him to in the direction of saying, and rightly so, that the science is sound and polar bears really are facing difficulties. So I think, you know, the real question that I'm sort of, I guess, thinking about here is how do you give the secretary enough confidence in the science that he's willing to make this decision and admit and sort of, you know, embrace the science when he knows full well that he's going to be sued by Reed Hopper and so many other people who don't want to take that step from denial to acceptance that there's a problem. And so in order to make the secretary sort of feel comfortable that he has a solid enough scientific foundation for saying that, yes, the polar bears are threatened by climate change, you have to do more than just say, oh, look, here are, you know, 10 climate models that say that sea ice is going to decline. You have to say as specifically as you can, what does that sea ice decline mean for polar bears? And to do that, and I think this is actually – it was the most fun part of working on this project, and I think it's also the most interesting for the public and scientifically. To do that, you have to have a true interdisciplinary collaboration between people that are sort of knowledgeable about climate and climate change and people who know something about polar bear biology, know something about demographics and demographic modeling, and know something about ecosystem dynamics. So I'm just going to talk about a couple of things that we did. And, you know, to give you a little bit of background on this, the Secretary of the Interior in 2007 commissioned the U.S. Geological Survey to conduct research on the current status and likely future status of polar bears throughout their range. And Stephen Amstrup, who's the lead polar bear specialist in Anchorage, put together a team of researchers to study this problem from a number of different angles. And I was one of those people on the team and wrote one report out of a series of 9 reports. The report that I wrote was about climate models, climate model uncertainty, things like that. And at the end of the report, one of the things that I do is I choose a subset of models which are regarded as sort of most credible models for looking at the likely outcome for the future. Now, but then the question becomes, well, what do you do with these climate models? You know, you've picked a set of them. You have all of the sea ice sort of outputs from those models. And to take the next step, you need to sort of have a friendly polar bear biologist from Anchorage sort of educate you a little bit about how polar bears use the ice.
Right.
And information about polar bears on ice comes from some interesting sources. There's an extensive amount of field work. There's tranquilizing polar bears from helicopters and then weighing them, measuring them, putting radio collars on them so you can see where they go. And from doing these kinds of activities, you can build up a picture of what does sea ice mean for polar bears. I think too many people have seen sort of the cover of Time magazine with a kind of polar bear standing on an isolated iceberg looking forlornly at the wine dark sea all around him. That's really not how polar bears live on ice. When they see ice, what they see is a kind of – it's almost like a country – a vast expanse of ice. It's the size of the United States at its wintertime sort of maximum extent. And it's a flat extent of ice. It has an ice edge, which is where you want to be because that's where seals will come up out of the water. And so you can sort of wax poetic about this, or you can derive a statistically derived resource selection function. And this is what George Derner and Steve Amstrup and others in the USGS office in Anchorage have done. And what that means is use the radio collar data on polar bears and use the satellite data that tells us where sea ice is to observe polar bears walking around on the ice and then ask the question, well, where do they like to be on the ice? Never mind models, never mind satellites, never mind that. If you're a polar bear, you know, where is your easy chair? You know, where is your comfortable spot on the ice? And so they came up with a very nice way of quantifying this called the resource selection function. What they found, and this makes perfect sort of biological sense, is that, first of all, the bear doesn't want to get too far away from land. One reason for that, and we're mostly talking about female bears because we care the fate of the species depends on the mothers. I think that's probably true of any species. They don't want to be too far away from the ice because they'll den on land when they give birth to their cubs. The second issue is if you're on the ice, you want to be near the ice edge. And that's fine because that's where the seals are. But a third issue is that you're better off being over shallow water. You want to be on the ice edge where the ice edge is over shallow water. And there's a reason for that, which is that where the water is shallow and you're over the continental shelf, it's very productive water. So that doesn't matter so much for the bear, but it matters for the seal. Yeah. Because that's the area where the ecosystem is productive. And I think that's true throughout the global ocean. The fish that you eat is fished off of places like the George's Banks and the Grand Banks where the water is relatively shallow. It means that the nutrients can be recycled into the sunlight. So that all makes sense. The problem is that when sea ice retreats, and this is sort of dramatically happening, especially last summer, you could see this, where the ice is left is over the deep water. So it's not so much a question of does the sea ice go away altogether.
It's not in the right place.
Is it over the shallow water? Is it over the place where the seals can have something to eat? Is there more than a 50% concentration of sea ice so that the bears can feel comfortable walking around on it? And so, you know, the issue of sea ice decline is not so stark as to say that the ice is just going away. What happens in climate model simulations, and it happened actually after the really, truly dramatic, just shocking loss of sea ice that we had last September, an area the size of Texas and Alaska combined got lost in a matter of 10 weeks or something like that. Really unprecedented stuff.
That's remarkable.
But the issue is that the ice will come back. There may, in fact, be plenty of ice in the winter. But this gets into polar bear biology because the importance of having ice in the summer is that you need that as a platform to hunt, and the ice has to be in the places where it'll be good hunting. And the importance of that is that bears, I think, in general, and particularly polar bear mothers, they live a feast and fast existence. So they'll be trying to eat as much as they can and store up as much body fat as they can all the time from, say, spring through summer so that they can come to land to den in the fall really well fattened up. And there's a reason for that because the mother polar bear will come on land in autumn and she'll build a maternity den out of snow. And she'll go into that den on the 1st of November. The cubs are born. There's usually two cubs born at the same time. They'll be born in December, say December 1st, something like that. And so she'll wean the cubs. And through the birth of the cubs and weaning them, the cubs will emerge in April. And each cub weighs about 25 pounds. Where did that mass come from? You know, 25 pounds, you can't just manufacture out of nothing. That mass comes from the nursing of the mother.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's all ultimately coming from the fat that she's stored up. So the question is, will a mother polar bear be able to store up enough fat so that she can come on shore in November and start a four-month-long fast, during which time she's giving birth and nursing cubs and losing 50% of her body weight to the cubs, and then emerge strong enough in the spring to hunt, teach the cubs to hunt and do all the things that they need to get on their feet.
Well, and have something to hunt, too.
And that's another issue, yeah, having something to hunt. But even assuming that sea ice conditions in April are still good because the maximum sea ice loss happens in September, there's still this issue of the seasonality.
And that brings up the question I guess I would have at the end, which is it too late? In other words, no matter what, have we doomed the polar bears
That's
in the
right.
Arctic?
Are we past a tipping point?
That's right. The issue of tipping points is everywhere today. And I don't have any particularly good news on that because, you know, as I mentioned before, last summer saw just an astounding loss of sea ice. And the predictions for this summer are almost equally bad. The issue there being that because the ice is very thin now, it's come back, it's covering the ocean, but it's not very thick. Now, I guess there's a couple of ways to go with this question. One is that there's two consequences to exposing the ocean. In summer, it absorbs sunlight, but you know that the Arctic has sort of an all-winter-long night and an all-summer-long day. Once the sun goes down in the Arctic, then having that expanse of open ocean, which is warm, makes it easy to form ice. When the sun goes down, and I think this would be true even under a global warming simulation, it's going to get cold in the Arctic. The temperature is going to fall below freezing, and so you're going to start to form ice. And the more open water you have, the more ice you form. It's much easier for an open ocean to lose heat because of just surface heat flux than it is for an ice-covered surface. As cold as the ice is, it forms a blanket over the ocean underneath it, which is still at sort of liquid ocean temperatures. So there's competing issues here. One is that there's a clear scientific justification for thinking that a tipping point would exist in this system. However, you can also go the other way with it, saying, well, you know, there's a positive feedback in the summer, but there's a negative feedback in the fall and the winter. So what I'm doing is I hope that it's not too late to save the polar bear. And the USGS research concluded that we'd expect something like 2/3 of the world's polar bear population to be gone by mid-century. But it also says that by the end of the century, polar bears will be reduced to a remnant population, probably living somewhere in the Canadian Arctic islands. If that's the case, it does hold out some hope. If you mitigate, if you do things to reduce the sea ice loss, there'd be some genetic pool of polar bears which could recolonize the Arctic. Now, if you've passed a tipping point, that's a very faint hope because you're sort of saying that, you know, having gone into this other climate state, you can't get back to where the polar bears want to be. So we've done these experiments. These are preliminary experiments. They're not meant to be realistic, but these are things that Marika Holland has done at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. The experiment is, what if we turned off all of our emissions in the year 2030, which is already a time which in the NCAR climate model, you know, you've lost substantial amounts of ice. Will the ice come back? And the answer is that, well, it sort of does. You know, the system is resilient enough that if you do something to control emissions, there is a chance for the sea ice to come back. Now, of course, that's only the first step because that's asking the thought question, what if you could turn off emissions tomorrow? I think you've already mentioned that it's not possible to simply turn off your car and throw away the key and not emit carbon dioxide tomorrow. But there are valid mitigation scenarios that are being constructed. James Hansen at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, for instance, has been working on this for a while. What would be a reasonable goal for possible limitations on emissions that wouldn't destroy the world economy? And so what we're doing right now is we're taking his mitigation scenario and we're running it in the NCAR climate model to see what happens in the sea ice. The advantage of doing it in the NCAR climate model is two advantages. One is it has the most realistic sea ice of any of the climate models. The other is that it demonstrates abrupt loss events in sea ice in the Arctic, where in model simulations with this model around the year 2030 or so, you get these catastrophic declines in sea ice extent. Not unlike, by the way, what happened last summer, only extended for, say, a decade or something like that. So if you can show using a mitigation scenario, which at least has been considered in terms of, you know, the possibility of doing it, the practicality of it, if you can show with that mitigation scenario in that climate model, which is known to have these abrupt loss events, that the system can bounce back, then I think that is actually a pretty compelling piece of evidence that it's not too late to save the polar bear.
Let's mitigate. That's what I suggest.
Absolutely.
See what we can do to give them the benefit of the doubt and cut back on those carbon dioxide emissions. Our guest has been Eric DeWeaver, making the link between climate models and the polar bear population. Thanks for joining us this hour.
Well, thanks again for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, we'll look at the latest developments and speculations regarding biofuels. If ethanol based on corn isn't the answer, what might be? Join us with our guest, Timothy Donahue, next Sunday afternoon at 4 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.